Hello. Can everyone hear me okay? Good, okay. We're going to start off now with our next session, which is all about accessing protection. Just a couple of words from me, then I'm going to move on to our panelists. I'm aware that, you know, we want to try and keep to time as best we can. But I just wanted to say, you know, it is a real privilege to be here, as it always is when you're in a room like this, you know, a room that's always so filled with hope and with love and with great inspiring people. And particularly so at the start of Refugee Week, you know, which is all about the welcome that we continue to provide to people trying to find sanctuary here in the UK. And I think given the, you know, the incredibly tragic, sad events of the last few days, I think the need for us to have that welcome embrace is probably more important now than it's ever been. I forgot to send in some speaker notes as to who I am, but I'm Alex Fraser. I'm the Director of Refugee Support and Restoring Family Links for the Red Cross. I won't bore you with too many details about me, other than to say that my heart beats with the blood of my father, and my father was a man who had to flee from conflict and persecution in 1939 from occupied Poland. And so, you know, I know a little bit about what it is to try and seek protection. And actually, I wouldn't be sitting here today had he not been given protection in the UK, and my two young children wouldn't be running around the house right now driving my wife mad if he hadn't been given that protection either. So it's a real pleasure to be here. And I think, yeah, the name of the event, what a great movement we continue to build, you know, this social movement for inclusive asylum. And we've got three great panellists here with their trowels in hand who are going to continue to build, put some more bricks into the building of that vision. I will introduce them all in a moment, but I'll just tell you a little bit about the session. So in this session, our panellists will be speaking about the challenges of accessing protection. And in the discussion that follows, I hope that we'll continue to build a greater sense of what more can be done, what more needs to be done, and what more we can all do, actually, to bring that change, to increase the likelihood of people finding sanctuary, securing protection, so that they can truly start to rebuild their lives with safety and dignity. So I'm going to introduce our panellists just in turn, and then before they speak, I'll tell you a little bit more about them. So we've got Gemma Gilley, sitting here to my left, the head of media at Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. You don't speak French as well as I do. And we have Katia Bianchini, research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for Religious and Ethnic Diversity in Göttingen. And my good friend Gonzalo Vargas Losa, representative from UNHCR in the UK. So our first panellist is going to be speaking is Gemma Gilley. Gemma is currently the head of press for MSF UK, having just come back from 2 years in the field. Now Gemma has spent much of the last year and the first part of this year, in fact, working on MSF's response in Greece. Speaking about her experiences in Greece, the difficulty in being able to access basic services, as well, of course, as protection. And Gemma's going to talk a little bit as well, I think, about the difficult principled decisions that MSF have to sometimes make in what is a very challenging and complex environment. Gemma.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me to speak on this. As I say, I think because I've spent so much of last year and the first 3 months of this year in Greece, I think I'm actually going to focus a lot on what I experienced there, because for me it kind of perfectly captures what's happening throughout Europe, and actually it's, you know, it's replicated in Italy, in France, wherever. So I was there, as you said, for a lot of last year and the first 3 months of this year, and watching the evolution of the response just in Greece alone was remarkable now that I stand and look back on it. So last April, we decided to launch a response in Idomeni. Now, Idomeni was just a small, unremarkable village in the north of Greece on the border with Macedonia. And that became the kind of official, unofficial crossing point into Macedonia as part of the Balkan route. There was nothing there. No access to any kind of services, any kind of protection whatsoever. And so as a temporary measure, we made a decision to launch a very small response. You know, literally a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist, a couple of cultural mediators who could speak various languages under a tree in a field. And it was a temporary measure because we thought, you know, just until the authorities are able to put something in place. Now, time went on, more and more people arrived, and it slowly started to dawn on us that no one's coming, that this is it, it's us. So we made the decision, which isn't actually something that MSF usually does, which was to construct a transit camp. So, you know, that people, as they were passing through, at the very least had access to water, shelter, medicine, a psychologist, food, you know, really, really basic services. That was fine. That was constructed. Everything was in place. And then mid-November, with no warning, no notice, no time for us to prepare, a decision was made overnight that only Syrians, Iraqis and Afghanis would be able to cross. So immediately, there's a complete change in what these people's needs are, because we now have two populations in the camp. One, who is a transit population, who, you know, we have to meet their needs for a matter of hours. And a second population now, who are essentially there indefinitely. We don't know where they can go. There's been nothing explained to them about what their rights are now that they cannot cross into Macedonia, and they are trapped in this transit camp. And just from a medical and psychological perspective, the needs of a semi-permanent population are very different to a transit population. So overnight, we had to completely almost create two little responses within the same camp. Inevitably, people kept arriving at that camp who weren't able to cross the border, and so around 3 weeks later, we had a population of 5,000 in this transit camp who had nowhere to go. And so on the 9th or 10th of December, I can't remember, I know it was a Wednesday, there were 300-400 riot police turned up in the camp with no notice, no warning, and sent everybody in the camp on buses back to Athens, completely cleared the camp, closed it. Nobody was allowed to access it anymore. So we've now gone from having access to these people, access to providing protection for them, and they've been transported away from us back to a city and dumped in a sports stadium where we have no idea what protection facilities are there, whether they have access to a doctor, are there enough toilets, is there water, you know, where are they going to sleep, nothing. So we'd gone from there. They then, what, for people who were able to still cross the border, they didn't even allow them to access the camp. What they did was get people off buses, walked them down the side of the camp straight over the Macedonian border. And for about a week, they were able to control that flow of people in Athens so that it, you know, people essentially would arrive in the north and cross straight over. There was no waiting around in the north of Greece because they wanted to avoid any kind of stationary settlement in the north. And then on Christmas Eve, of all nights, we got a phone call from one of our staff members who was just driving home from work and said, guys, do you know that there's a few hundred refugees at the side of the road, 20 kilometres from this camp? So we drove, and right enough, by the time we got there, there were over 1,000 refugees at a petrol station at the side of the road of a motorway, 20 kilometres from our camp. No warning, no notice. And what we learned had happened was that the Macedonians had gone on holiday because it was Christmas. They'd closed the border. They hadn't warned Greece. And so, you know, the Greek authorities had allowed this flow of people to go up to the north, assuming they would be able to cross the border, found out the border was closed, refused to let them into Idomeni camp because they didn't want a population in that camp. And so they left them at this petrol station. And I regret actually not bringing a picture of it, because I really mean a petrol station at the side of a motorway. Nothing. There was literally nothing there. And it was -4. It was snowing. It was just unbelievable. And so obviously your immediate thing is, okay, well, we need to get in tents. We need to bring in some food. We need to bring our medical clinic. But it's private land, you know, and it's owned by the petrol station owner, who was looking out of his forecourt, seeing the biggest opportunity of his life, business-wise, because he has 1,000 people who have no food, no water, and can only buy it from him. So it's not as simple as just saying, okay, we'll come in and put everything in place. We have to negotiate with this man, which wasn't easy, I can assure you. But we did. And so we came and we started to, you know, we put in tents, we brought in 20 tons of firewood so that people would be able to stay warm overnight, which I appreciate isn't sensible in a petrol station. there were rules put in place, and we had a fireman on site, I assure you all. But, I mean, for me, it's a perfect example of an imperfect solution to a huge problem. You know, you kind of have to find the least bad option with what you're given. So we basically started replicating all the facilities and all the services that were in Idomeni camp, 20 kilometres away, at a petrol station while all of these services in Eden Many stood unused just because the authorities wouldn't allow them to be accessed. Fine, we did it. Alongside that, we then had to launch another parallel response for all of the people who had now been marginalised or excluded from services in Greece because they were the bad refugees, you know, the people who were no longer allowed to cross the border. So Algerians, Moroccans, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis. And you can't imagine the situation these people were in. They basically had just been forgotten by all of Europe. There was no protection or dignity awarded to them whatsoever. They were living, there was hundreds of people living in a forest with no tent, no blankets, no water, open defecation, no food. It was appalling. So alongside this response at the petrol station, 5 kilometres away in a forest, we're now responding to these people as well, with the constant threat from the police that they might arrest us for responding there because we're providing access, you know, we're providing protection to people who don't have a right to be here. So we find ourselves doing ridiculous things like parking our mobile medical clinic behind a car wash so that people can't see it from the road when the police drive past. I mean, it became absurd. Around the third week in January, I came out of a meeting with Mazalis, who's the migration minister in Greece, who had spent the last half an hour insisting to myself and the head of mission that the camp in Idomeni would not ever reopen. I walked out the meeting, I turned on my phone, and I had 3 texts from the team in the north saying, Idomeni's been opened! So somehow between him saying it wasn't going to open, it then opened. But now, in a 20-kilometre radius, you have the response in the petrol station, the response in the forest, and also now the response in the camp, because they were still using the petrol station as a control mechanism so that there was only a few hundred people in Idomeni camp at any one time. So it was essentially just a staging mechanism to get people to each place. And then from that point onwards, it was a very quick descent and a range of kind of new policies introduced with no notice and no warning. You know, Afghanis were not able to cross, and then people who didn't have passports weren't able to cross, and then eventually the full closure of the Balkan route in total. And that left around 16,000 people stranded in Idomeni camp alone. And if you consider that the camp had shelter capacity for 1,500 people, it was a challenging time. And then after that, you know, 7 days later, it was the EU-Turkey deal, which kind of provoked us and thankfully UNHCR and a number of other organisations to withdraw from our activities inside the hotspot on Lesbos because, you know, we weren't prepared to allow our support and our protection to be instrumentalised in what for us was a completely inhumane policy. But for me, that's what all of this comes down to, and it's the fact that when I stop and I look back, so much of what we've been doing is providing protection to these people from Europe and from their policies. It's essentially just been a long line of policies that just go against the values and principles that are needed to actually afford protection to people. And trying to navigate that and toe the line between providing protection, without allowing your response and your activities to become instrumental to these policies is incredibly hard, and it's a constant battle with us. And I guess we'll come on to some of the bigger decisions, principle-wise, that we've had to take. But for us, and thankfully, and a number of other organisations, the EU-Turkey deal was a complete red line for us. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'll leave it there. I don't want to talk too long. But for me, that situation in the north of Greece just perfectly captures what is happening throughout Europe, which is that there's inconsistent and incoherent reception facilities. And alongside that, a line of kind of unprepared and ill-thought-through policies that are just adding to the risk and the harm that is being afforded to these people who have come here seeking nothing but protection. And let's remember, are owed and have the right to their most basic needs and basic levels of protection being met while they're here. So I shall finish there.
Wow, thank you. Thank you, Gemma. That was really extraordinary. I look forward to asking you a question after all our panellists have spoken. So, do you want to go and prepare? Whilst Katia goes and prepares her presentation over there, I'll just give a short introduction. So Katia Bianchini is a research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for Religious an ethnic diversity in Göttingen, a legal expert. Katia's research focuses on statelessness, refugee law and immigration detention. As a member of the European Network on Statelessness, ENS, Katia will introduce the network and the work that they do, talk about statelessness and why it's such a major area of concern right now. And of course the problems in accessing protection for people who are stateless within the UK. Katia.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Today I will talk very briefly about the European Network on Statelessness. I will explain what statelessness is and then explain what are the major problems in accessing protection for stateless persons, especially in the UK. The European Network on Statelessness is a network of NGOs, academics, lawyers and experts on statelessness, and the aim is to improve the protection of stateless persons in Europe and then statelessness. The main goals of the European Network on Statelessness are to engage in research, raise awareness, and engage in capacity building. The ENS was founded in 2012, and now we have members in 39 countries. The key outputs and thematic priorities have been three. The first one that was started in 2014 was about improving protection for stateless persons. And one of the major outcomes of our work was to produce a report that looked at the international standards and how they are implemented in the UK and in a number of other European countries. We looked at examples of good practices and challenges. You can find the report online. Then another major work that we engaged with was looking at the protection of children in Europe and ensure that no child born in Europe is going to remain stateless. And this resulted in a report, and I left a few copies upstairs if you are interested. And then the other major thematic priority is looking at the link between statelessness and immigration detention. We have already produced a regional toolkit for practitioners and three reports on three countries, Malta, the Netherlands, and Poland. And now we're working on other three reports. And I'm the consultant for the report on the UK. And it's going to be launched in November. The population of concern for the European Network on Statelessness are stateless persons, and we have to distinguish them from refugees. A stateless person can also be a refugee, but in that case he's going to be protected under the better regime of the Refugee Convention. But ENS is concerned only with stateless persons that are not refugees. You can find the definition of stateless person in Article 1 of the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons. A stateless person is defined as a person who is not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its law. I don't have time to now discuss this definition, which is actually giving rise to a number of problems as far as its interpretation, but I'm happy to answer questions at the end. Who are stateless persons in Europe? The UNHCR estimates that there are at least 670,000 people that are stateless, but we believe that the numbers are actually lower. Sorry, the number actually higher, because stateless persons are a hidden population. Many times, stateless persons do not know to be stateless. And also in Europe, there are very few states that have implemented mechanisms to identify stateless persons. In many states, stateless persons figure under statistics as persons with unknown nationality or unclear nationality. In some cases, I've seen stateless persons being attributed a nationality because they come from a certain country, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they are national of that country. An example of stateless persons that we have in Europe are the Palestinians from the occupied territories once they migrate here. Another example is that of the Roma, the Kurds, but also many, many other people. As far as the causes of statelessness, the main cause of statelessness is state succession. And this is what happened, for example, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, when many states were formed, but the nationalities law were not harmonized. And that left many people stateless. You have the situation when a person remains stateless because of conflict of laws. For example, a child is born in a country from foreign parents, and the country where he's born doesn't give nationality jus soli, and the laws of nationality of the parents do not give nationality jus sanguinis. So unless you have specific protection in place, that child is going to remain stateless. You have the case of discriminatory laws, and that, for example, happens quite often in the Middle Eastern countries. For instance, in some countries of the Middle East, children born out of the wedlock cannot acquire the nationality of the mother. You have cases of withdrawal of nationality. For example, if a person refuses to do military service in a state, the state may decide to withdraw nationality. And then you have migration. Of course, not everybody that is without documents that comes here is going to be stateless. But you have the situation where someone comes here with no documents because he has never had them or they are destroyed. But maybe he lived in different countries before. And then when attempts are made to try to establish his identity and nationality, it becomes very difficult to find out whether or not he's a national of a state. The communications with the embassies of the country of origin are not fruitful. Maybe the embassies say that he doesn't have a nationality or doesn't have document to establish that. And if this situation becomes prolonged over the years, then the person can be found to be stateless. So statelessness is a big human rights problem because a stateless person doesn't enjoy the two main rights that are attached to nationality, which are the rights to reside, enter and live in a state, the person also doesn't have diplomatic protection. And as a consequence of not having these two rights, then the person is going to encounter a number of problems when he's trying to access economic, social, political rights. But I also would like to point out that statelessness is a problem for the state as well, because the state ends up having people whose identity and nationality is unknown within its territories. And of course, then there are problems for security, for immigration control and enforcement. Now, aware of all the problems that statelessness can create, the UK adopted a specific statelessness determination procedure in 2013, and that happened after the very good work done by the UNHCR and Asylum Aid, and following also the publication of a report that was called Mapping Statelessness in the UK. So now the very good news is that there is a determination procedures in the UK, and statelessness is a specific protection ground. However, there are a number of problems in the procedures, which I would like to briefly point out. The first one is that the burden of proof to establish that a person is not a national under the operation of any law is higher than in refugee status determinations. So a person has to prove, according to the CD standard burden of proof, that he is not a national of any state. And this is also contrary to the initial recommendation that a person should establish this only to a reasonable degree. Another problem is that if a case is refused, there is no right of appeal. It's only possible to do a judicial review. There is no legal aid to prepare an application, again, contrary to the treatment that refugees receive. And in the new determination procedures, there are some exclusion clauses that are not found in the 1954 Convention. And then another major problem is that practically the procedures are not easily accessible. One of the reasons is that, for example, to make an application, you must fill out a form, which is very long and keeps repeating the questions in different ways, so it can be confusing for someone that doesn't have legal skills or knowledge of the system or whose language is not, first language is not English. Unlike in asylum cases where a person simply says, I need protection, then the procedures are started. This is not the case for stateless persons. You must do a formal application. Then another problem is that there are delays in obtaining a decision. The average time I've heard is about a year and a half, and during that time the person is not entitled to any benefits or is not entitled to work. Again, this is unlike refugees that are entitled to receive some support. And another major problem that creates a problem of access to protection in the end is that stateless persons are very vulnerable to immigration detention. Of course, they do not have documents, and this is a vulnerability. They have no embassies that is going to reply that they are nationals or that is going to assist with the documentation process. And so while the Home Office attempts to establish their nationality or effectuate or enforce removals, they're often detained. And from detention, of course, access to support groups, NGOs, or whatever kind of support, because it becomes even more difficult. Another problem that creates barriers to protection is that the new procedures have not been integrated with the existing immigration rules or legislation. And so when an immigration officer is going to assess whether or not the person can be removed, statelessness is not going to be taken into consideration. During the preparation of the report for ENS, I came across several stateless persons that not only were in immigration detention, but the characteristics that they shared was that they were in detention for a really long period of times, and sometimes subject to more than an episode of immigration detention, because anytime they're released, but then they breach a condition of release, or maybe the Home Office decides that now it has become possible to obtain documents, they can be detained again. Another thing is I cannot really draw some qualitative conclusions because I only interview 8 persons, but 3 of these people were detained for nearly 3 years in immigration detention. Another major problem that I came across was the poor quality of decision making, especially in especially as far as the detention case workers. And it was striking that sometimes they would not take into consideration evidence of vulnerabilities that they should have, for example, because the person was victim of torture or had serious mental health issues. And also the other thing that I found out is that in many cases there is no real engagement with cases. And when they have to look at whether or not to maintain immigration attention, in many cases it just looks like they are copying and pasting their decisions. The bottom line of today is that we have had improvements in the UK with the adoption of the statelessness determination procedures, but there are still many problems to deal with to increase access to protection.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Katya. That was really fascinating. And look forward to asking you a couple of questions, then obviously putting the audience to ask you some as well. So our final panelist is Gonzalo Vargas Losa, representative for the UNHCR in the UK. Gonzalo took up his post as UNHCR's representative in October 2014 in the UK, having spent 4 years as representative in the Dominican Republic. He's also served in New York, Panama, Geneva headquarters, as well as in emergency missions in Pakistan, Darfur, Sudan, and Libya. Gonzalo.
First of all, thank you very much to the organizers for this meeting. I think it's also very timely, just happening a couple of days before World Refugee Day. I'm also very glad that there was an item included on statelessness. This is an issue which is very close to UNHCR's heart and to my heart, as I spent almost 5 years in the Dominican Republic just focusing on that. Unlike the refugee crisis, it is a crisis worldwide and Europe-wide, but it's an invisible one. And it's one that, that's why I'm very happy that it was included today. And I think it's an area where civil society needs to get much more engaged, like it has done on the refugee side, if we want meaningful progress. First of all, a word of apologies in advance. I think that after you listening to the fantastic individual and collective work that the panelists in the first session were doing or have been doing, and also what our colleague from MSF, the perspective from the ground, I'm going to sound like very much like a United Nations bureaucrat over the next few minutes. So please bear with me. I think what I would like to do today is I'm going to try to link a bit some of the flaws or lessons learned from the refugee crisis in Europe with what are the advocacy challenges and operational challenges for all of us, but particularly for the civil society as we move forward, given that the title of this conference, after all, is Building a Social Movement for Inclusive Asylum. I think that looking back at the past year in Europe, but also looking forward, I mean, I would say that the first major challenge is fighting in a very resolute manner the myths, the wrong myths, the untrue myths. And of course, when I mention that, what I mean is the myth that Europe is being invaded, that Europe is being flooded, that Europe is about to collapse because of the refugees arriving. I think it's a myth that has been very well used, very effectively used by those who want to deny protection to refugees. And we have to be as strategic and as smart and as effective as they are. In fact, we have to be more effective than they are if we want to maintain the asylum regime in Europe. And the good thing is that the truth, in this case, the facts are on our side and not on their side. Now, as you know, UNHCR publishes every year what we call the Global Trends Report, which gives statistics about refugees and persons of concern. We will release the one showing the data until the end of 2015 in 2 days. I am afraid that I'm not allowed, otherwise, especially if this is being filmed, I would lose my job if I tell you what those figures are. But what I can tell you is this, is that a year ago, there were 60 million people who had been forced out of their homes. As you will see on Monday, as of, I think, 5 a.m., when the report will be released, this number has not only not decreased, but it has increased. And it has increased in what I would say, again, not breaking the embargo, in what we consider to be in a relatively significant manner. Now, you will also see that there's a list of the in that report of the 10 top refugee hosting countries in the world. And not a single Western European country is on that list. So, yes, the arrival of a million or so, mostly refugees in Europe, in the past year is not an insignificant number. Yes, we have to recognize that. But when you put that in the more global perspective, I think that you have to recognize that the vast majority of the responsibility, we call it responsibility, others call it burden for hosting refugees, is not on Western Europe, it's on developing countries, on poor countries. And I think that this is a message that we have to be much more effective with the help of civil society in getting across. I think the other challenge, again, looking at the history of the last year, is we have to be more forceful in our advocacy in pressing governments, particularly in Europe, but of course elsewhere, to be much more generous in terms of providing aid to the refugees in their regions of origin. Now, organizations like ANS, MSF, UNICEF, WFP, we had been warning for at least a couple of years, the world, that the conditions for Syrian refugees in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, were degrading to such a level that it was inevitable that at some point they would start moving in bigger numbers towards Europe. The fact is that we were not listened to, or were not listened to sufficiently. And that's exactly what happened. The combination after 4 or 5 years of war, of losing any hope of going back home, on the other hand, degrading conditions, as I said, for refugees in the neighboring countries, less access to education, to meaningful employment, to the most basic services. I mean, it's inevitable. I would have done exactly the same thing if I was a Syrian refugee. I would have looked to Europe as my salvation, and that's what they did, and that's why they started moving. So I think that's an area which we have to also focus on. I think the third one is the issue of the response of Europe, which is both a preventive response and a post-arrival response. I think this was an extraordinary weakness in the past year. I mean, many of us, again, had been calling for quite some time, I've been saying to Europe, you have to use legal safe pathways to bring some of these refugees, particularly Syrians, but of course not only Syrians, to places in Europe, because the pressure on the host countries is in the regions is such that people are going to move. So they will have two choices. Either they will move if you provide more resettlement numbers, more humanitarian visa possibilities, more labor mobility initiatives. Otherwise, they will go on their own. They will do it by sea, and thousands will die on the way. What happened? The response, in that sense, also was very limited. It was largely limited to resettlement. And yes, thank you to those countries, including the UK, that has pledged resettlement numbers. But again, the numbers were insignificant compared to the need. So people started to move with all the consequences that...
I think your boss on the phone.
Yes. I think obviously I've overstepped the mark.
The press office. UNHCR.
The other one, of course, so one is, if you like, I'm not sure, I don't like the word preventive, but that's what I mean, you know, if they would have brought many people through safe ways, they wouldn't have had to travel. The other is the, you know, and I think you described it so well from a field perspective. I mean, we have to insist, it is not possible that Europe, which is, you know, a relatively wealthy region with relatively solid, at least in many of the countries, asylum systems, that it can have such a poor, disorganized and chaotic reception system for those refugees that decide to come on their own. And there I really don't have much to add, because I think you've said it. You've said it all. But the problem also with that total lack of organization, of order, and of responsibility sharing between the European states when refugees did arrive in very large numbers. For example, you know, there were great promises about relocation of refugees. Let's look at Greece. There were, what was it? They agreed to relocate 66,000 asylum seekers from Greece. I think that so far only 1,200 have actually been relocated. Now, the problem is that so you had a context at that time in which, on the one hand, you have the Merkel response, the Merkel signal, which was, I mean, fantastic, and really chapeau to the Chancellor in showing such moral leadership. But that would only work, that could have only worked, if at the same time there was an organized response to people's arrival and effective responsibility sharing in terms of distributing the refugees. But because one came and the other didn't come, then all you had was the Chancellor saying welcome, and then people seeing on their televisions absolute chaos. All this manipulated by politicians saying Europe is being flooded, Europe can't stand this anymore, this is not sustainable. There was an impression among the public in Europe that there was no control, that nobody was in charge, and that in fact, you know, and maybe with some reason, for those who don't really know so much, that yes, there was some kind of invasion going on, and the politicians were incapable of doing anything about it. So then, that generosity, that moral leadership shown by Ms. Merkel and so many others, turned. It turned because people started to get scared. The average citizens started to get scared, even in Germany, in places where they had received so many. Then politicians, of course, started to get scared. And then we know what happened. Barriers started going up, borders started closing, and then came the EU-Turkey deal. So this is another area where I think our advocacy has to focus very much, insisting on governments that it is not possible that in Europe, particularly in Europe, you have such such ad hoc, one ad hoc response, and also such lack of responsibility sharing spirit among among states. I was going to say something maybe about the challenges more in terms of protection in the UK, but I think that I will now move on, and then maybe if there are questions, I can look at that. I think looking ahead, maybe just a couple of reflections before I close. I think that obviously I don't have the UNHCR doesn't have the magic formula to make sure that things improve, things progress, policies are better, the responses are better. But one thing I am absolutely sure is that organizations such as UNHCR, which are those officially entrusted by the international community to ensure the protection of refugees, and together, of course, with all the traditional international and NGO actors who work on behalf of refugees, we can no longer on our own significantly influence positively government policy. Of this we have become absolutely, at least UNHCR has become absolutely convinced. I remember when I joined 25 years ago UNHCR, it was a different context. Many of these issues were resolved amicably through dialogue with governments. This is no longer going to happen. It can only happen with the help of civil society, who politicians listen to. And there, I think there were two or three examples cited earlier in the UK. If it was not for the extraordinary outpour of support from citizens all around the United Kingdom, which was there already, but I think it was obviously accelerated by the picture of Aylan Kurdi. I can tell you, without that movement, probably today the UK government would have only committed to bring a few hundred Syrian refugees. If today they have pledged 20,000 plus 3,000 unaccompanied, children at risk, this is 99% because of civil society. So that is where the answer. That's an enormous responsibility, but I think that it's the key. And I would just end by saying that I think that the critical thing is that advocacy, but also operational response, because it's not just that the civil society is doing great advocacy. For example, in the UK now, with the activation of the private community sponsorship program for Syrian refugees, civil society is not only going to do advocacy, but it's actually going to assume some of the financial responsibilities, if you like, for taking care of refugees. That response has to be very well targeted, because good emotions, good feelings, good intentions, if they're not channeled in order to achieve very specific, concrete objectives and results, then in the long run it may not be sustainable. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gonzalo. I think the power of civil society, the incredible pragmatic agility to make difficult decisions from MSF, and of course the phenomenal challenges that stateless people face. I was going to ask some questions myself, but you know what I'm going to do, because I'm aware of the time. I'm going to ask our wonderful audience of people gathered here today if you have some questions, because I think it's probably better and the right thing to do, given that you've all listened to such fascinating, lots of hands going up. I think if we do like before, maybe take three or four questions, and then I'll bring them back to the panellists, to Gemma, Katia and Gonzalo. Okay, so we have the challenge of, I know we haven't got much time, and there's some very complicated questions there. So maybe just, Gonzalo, very quickly, if you can start by asking the question around holding governments to account. I think it was a very particular question asked of UNHCR.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't suggesting that we would relinquish our mandate or anything like that, Alexander. I think it's a matter of strategy. I mean, of course, we will continue to play our role. We have our leadership mandate, both in terms of, promoting policies, promoting standards, giving technical advice to governments, trying to negotiate with governments. But, without relinquishing that, I think that itself will not, in many cases, in this context, I mean, this is our experience. It's not. It will not move government policy on its own. Not always. Let me give you an example. An area where I think I would like civil society to work much more. Because they may be able to influence policy where we have not yet been able to. And that's on the issue of Eritreans. You know what's been happening in the UK. The UK has changed its policy towards Eritrean asylum seekers, who have been historically one of the most significant asylum seeking caseloads in the UK. The UK government has changed its policy, to our mind, arbitrarily in the past year, and as such, the recognition rates for Eritrean asylum seekers have gone in the past year from about 80% to about 40% in the first instance, without, as far as we know, any dramatic improvement in the human rights situation in Eritrea. Now, at least for the past year, UNHCR has been trying to dialogue with the government on a low-key manner, on a, through the diplomatic paths, to try to get them to rectify, because there is absolutely no justification to halve the recognition rates of Eritreans. Alexander, we have not succeeded in doing so, in spite of the letters and of the meetings and of the discussions and pleas. Now, this is an issue which actually is not known to the majority of people in the UK, that something as serious as this is happening. This is an area, for example, where I would see that we could complement our efforts. I mean, we have the arguments, the tools, the evidence to show the government that there is no justification for what you are doing. But if that is complemented then with a big push from the civil society saying to the UK government, this is not only not justifiable to UNHCR, but it's not justifiable to the UK public. And we don't want 60% of Eritrean asylum seekers who arrive in the UK to be rejected on first instance. You know, we may together have much more effect. And so I see that formula working also for the global compact. I think now what we're going to try to do over the next few weeks, in terms of, I think you're also referring to the 19th September high-level meeting on refugees and migrants that will take place at the UN General Assembly. You know, you've seen the document. It's a very broad document, and it's great. It's got the right elements. But if we're going to turn that into concrete achievements, into concrete commitments by governments, we have to work now at the national level, and we don't have a lot of time over the next few weeks, and that's what I'm going to try to do with civil society, so that civil society presses government, for example, in the UK, to make specific commitments or concessions or improvements when they attend that meeting, or when they attend the next meeting the next day that President Obama is convening. So I think it's an issue of course, we have the leadership, we have the mandate, but in this kind of context, I think that and you know that we've listened to examples this morning. The role of civil society is absolutely critical.
Thank you. I think we've only got about 3 minutes left, so we'll have to get some quite pacey answers for the remaining questions. And I'm sure we can carry on discussing this through lunch and, of course, the rest of the conference. But there was a question around discrimination experience within the encampment. So I wonder, Gemma, if you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm going to really quickly try and cover all three with one simple thing, which is what I think is like, what do we need to do? We need to find, forgive my language, outrage. I think we've lost that in all of this. And I think it's not just about Europe, it's not just about wherever we are, it's actually that we need to find our outrage again. We've become so immune to all these stories that they're not affecting us, and we are not holding governments to account in the way that we should be with the atrocities that are happening. I touched on instrumentalisation in terms of your question, and that's what I was getting at. And actually, it's not playing the game of the governments, and that's what we're constantly trying to do. It's not allowing our support and our response to then be it's us versus them, which happened a lot, and it's actually what I think the governments wanted to happen, is that for it to be Syrians versus so-and-so. It's this good refugee, bad refugee argument. And that's what I'm saying a lot in terms of we've made some really big principled decisions this year, which I'll be honest, aren't comfortable for MSF. We've made yesterday a huge announcement about our funding, which honestly is a huge risk for us, because we just can't allow our response anymore in any of our operations throughout the world. And this, you know, it could be Nigeria, Eritrea. We work in all of these places. We're working on the Mediterranean. We just can't allow anymore ourselves to have anything to do with these authorities, because they are intentionally trying to create these parallel systems, trying to create friction, trying to create confusion. For their own gains, and we just won't be part of it. And I guess the last question, we've always said this is about individuals, this isn't a concept, refugees isn't a concept, these are people. And this is about témoignage. Every single person has a story, every single person has an individual experience, and you know, from a fundamental perspective, those people have the right to protection, and they have the right to have their claims and what's happened to them heard in a respectful and dignified manner. So to address your question, you know, it comes back to the beginning. We all have to find our outrage again and ignite that in other people in order for so many of these things to actually be addressed at a national and European level.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you. And I think it goes for all. Although we're presented in quite a formal way today, meet us at lunchtime, and we all share that same passion and outrage. You know?
Yes,
and sometimes we kind of present it in a slightly more formal fashion. But the courage you show and you stand up when you talk like that, that makes us go back and do even more to make sure we put as much of our resources into the right places. Because, you know, we're affected by all the stuff that we continue to see and experience. And, you know, and so the courage you show today, that will only make us even more, as you said, you know, unwilling to accept the status quo, you know, to keep agitating things, you know, to keep pushing things in a different direction, you know. I just want to give maybe Katia the final word. I know we've hugely run over, and I must apologise for that, but what can you do? Katia, maybe just a final word. I think particularly about detention and people who are stateless, who after 3 years are detained. Maybe do you want to say something just a little bit about that?
Well, I have to say that these people in the end got damages for unlawful detention, for a period of time of their immigration detention, at least. Sorry. Yes, well, I have to say that all these people in the end got damages for unlawful detention, for a part of their detention, at least. But I think that what we could do as civil society is lobby for the introduction of time limit to immigration detention. In all other European countries, yes. I think except Denmark, there is a limit of 6 months. And I think that recently some attempts were made in the UK to propose a time limit of 28 days, but that didn't work. So that's a very important first step. And then another thing that we could do as civil society is maybe improve cooperation and exchange of information whenever we find a person in immigration detention that seems like having problems with the documentation process with his embassies or with the relevant embassies. Because what I realized talking with NGOs and solicitors and visiting groups is that sometimes it was clear that someone could not be removed, but there was no exchange of information, no referrals to some NGOs that can actually help stateless persons in immigration detention. And of course, the matter of identification of these cases is not easy, but we are planning a number of trainings on statelessness.
Thank you, Katia. I think that, as I say, that's all we've unfortunately got time for in this particular session. Just, I think, the final thing I would say is let's just all continue to, you know, stay outraged, you know, and not rest. Let's not rest, okay? And I just want to say a great big thank you to Gemma, Katia, and Gonzalo. Thank you very much.